Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1987, features the late professors Sidney Hook, Hoover Fellow, and Tibor McCann, professor at Auburn University, as they explore the controversial life and ideology of Karl Marx, giving particular attention to Marx's ideas on work. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
This week we deal with communism, not Soviet communism, but communism as defined by the German social philosopher Karl Marx. Guiding us through his ideas will be Sidney Hook, a lifelong student of Marxism. Marx's story is fascinating, but beware. His ideas are interpreted in many different ways.
Capitalism at work, abundance produced by human beings and machine. This automation would have been inspiring to Karl Marx. For Marx, work was the most vital element of any culture. But the work he had in mind was very different. Marx's ideas came in large part from reflections on the lives of the textile workers of 19th century England. These are 20th century workers. Every day they give a demonstration of textile making. Quarry Bank Mill in Cheshire, England is the last working remnant of an industrial revolution that was to change human lives throughout Marx's life. Here, in a typical English green and pleasant valley, rural England's peace was to be shattered by the first beats of the machine culture. Gone forever was the steady spindling of cottage weaving. Now, the machine ruled. 1,000 spindles rattled miles of yarn, which demanded that hundreds of workers, men, women, and children, paced their lives to the thwack of the flying shuttles. Here, capital forced the pace, driving the lives of those in the weaving shed, and the capitalists who owned the capital ruled.
Industrial capitalism, for Marx, was not an accident of human history. It's not because human beings thought of free trade or discovered the division of labor that it came about. No, rather, it was a necessary part of humanity's development. Humanity went through several stages. First came its infancy in tribalist stage, then its childhood during feudalism, and now we are in capitalism, its adolescence. Industrial capitalism brings about the machine, which is a liberating tool for Marx. It frees human beings from menial labor, from chores, and allows them to engage in creative work. It makes man a master of nature, not nature a master of man.
19th century Europe was a period of great optimism and progress. With industrialization came railways, bridges, and factories, and changes in how the world looked. Achievement, it was felt, came from the application of science. For scholars, it was vitally important to be scientific, and Marx was no exception. This is the Herbarium at Kew Gardens in London. It's one of the world's largest collection of botanical specimens, a database for botanists, a full record of the natural history and evolution of plants.
In a similar way, Marx, the scientific philosopher, sought his database in the known developments of human society. He considered himself a natural historian of humanity, tracing its inevitable evolutionary improvement, but with a difference. Marx's perspective, however, was revolutionary and not evolutionary. And when Marx was studying humanity's development, he was not referring to individual human beings, but that of the human species as an organic whole.
Rosa Luxemburg hat doch damit überhaupt nichts zu tun mit Marx.
These students are from Berlin's Free University. They relish intense political debates. They're doing exactly what Marx loved to do when, as an 18-year-old, he came to Berlin to study. Marx was a ferocious debater. Aggressively shouting down those who disagreed with him, attacking both their motives and personality. In Berlin, he found his intellectual roots.
In the same way, that these students are influenced by their teachers, Marx's ideas reflected those of his, the philosopher Hegel. Hegel's influence was enormous. He had worked out a system for analyzing the progress of ideas through history. His central principle was the dialectic, a series of clashes between new ideas and actual reality.
I suppose one way to understand this is somewhat the way in which this film is being made. First you have an idea, then certain steps are taken to institute the idea, and then that modifies the idea of the film, and that goes on until finally you have a resolution in the thing that you're looking at right now.
So to Hegel, the truth about the world changes through time, and the actual world is what interested Marx. He had also been greatly taken by the ideas of Ludwig Feuerbach, a philosopher who insisted on the scientific approach that we can only know what we can perceive through our senses.
Marx got the idea of the dialectical process from Hegel, but he was a materialist, which he learned from Feuerbach. This is why it's said of him that he turned Hegel upside down. Now, materialism to Marx meant that we are always living with a direct involvement with the concrete, natural world around us. Hence, there is no room for spiritual reality, no room for religion.
Marx was quickly to apply his ideas to the concrete, social world of human beings. This is Trier, a small middle-class town on the Moselle, not far from Cologne in Germany. Marx knew the region and its people. He was born and brought up here. His father was a middle-class lawyer living in this house. Leaving university, Marx had joined a newspaper in Cologne, the Rheinische Zeitung, which covered events in this area. Near Trier, the Moselle River winds through a deep valley. Beneath the forests at the top lie hundreds of vineyards. These are the vines which produce the Moselle wine. If you've ever drunk Peace Porter, this is Peace Port. Families have worked these small, steep vineyards for centuries. Andreas Schiebens used to be his father's, before that his grandfather's. Winter here is bleak. In Marx's day, when harvests failed, there was appalling poverty. Villagers would climb to the forests and gather wood to bring it back down the steep slopes for their fires. The owners of the forests had traditionally turned a blind eye to this foraging. The wood had been considered common property. However, after a succession of bad harvests, the landowners realized that their wood resources were valuable and began to prevent the villagers from collecting.
Now, Marx took note of these developments and began to formulate several of his ideas that would eventually become the centerpiece for his political economy.
At Trier, then, Marx saw clear examples of the influence of the institution of private property and worker exploitation, the determination of human relations by economic forces, and the role of class conflict.
We might even say that this was the birth of scientific socialism.
That the clash between landowners was economic, and that it might lead to a new historical reality are vital early insights for Marx's science. He was only beginning to formulate his ideas.
Why is it that Marx became convinced of the significance of economic factors in the development of societies?
Marx realized that the nature of property is defined not so much by the use that people make of what they own, but by the power to exclude others from the use of what they own. That you have a very definite power over them as human beings. In other words, property meant power. But Marx's real contribution arose from his claim that it was the way in which the property relations were organized that determined the aspirations, the motivations, the institutions of society.
Was it really valid to generalize from that case of the wood
theft to all property relations? After all, there are some property relations that come from creativity, not from natural abundance.
Yes. The fundamental distinction, however, that Marx makes was between personal property and what he calls social property.
Was this also the source of Marx's belief in class conflict and the different outlooks of members of classes?
Naturally, it would follow as he reflected upon the importance of the property relationship, that the appeal that the peasants would make to the benevolence of the feudal lords is not likely to lead to a redistribution of property. And it was at this point that he stresses the inescapable necessity of struggle. He begins to see all of history in terms of the class struggles. Now, this is obviously exaggeration, because history is not only the history of class struggles, it's the history of class cooperation. Society is not always involved in struggles. But his contribution was to stress the importance of struggle and its pervasiveness.
Mid-19th century Europe was a continent of enormous inequalities. Dynastic monarchs inhabited huge palaces. This one belonged to the King of Prussia. Social status and privilege were determined by birth. A preoccupation with class was quite normal. Facing up to these entrenched privileges were many thinkers and writers who called themselves socialists. Their vision, the end of privilege, and the common management of all property. Marx, who read with an intensity which scholars even today find remarkable, absorbed their ideas and began adapting them to his view of the world. These were dangerous politics to adopt. Marx, despite his studying, found time to get married. Jenny Westphalen was the daughter of a local nobleman. She was only 22, and she might have thought twice if she had known what lay ahead. Marx was looking for adventure as an active radical. He chose Paris to find out more about socialist ideas. Since the revolution of 1789, Paris had been a hothouse for democratic experiment, particularly socialist theorizing. As intellectuals do even today, Marx shunned the grand establishments near the royal palaces. Instead, he settled for the south or left bank, a warren of narrow streets, awash with human variety. Marx spent his days here reading, learning, and fraternizing with new friends. Heinrich Heine, a radical poet. Arnold Rouget, a journalist and socialist. He met up with Proudhon, doyen of the utopian socialists. And Friedrich Engels, manager of a textile mill in England, but a socialist. They were to begin to build a lasting friendship here. Marx and Jenny spent too much money in places like this, frittering away a legacy from Jenny's parents amongst their newfound socialist friends.
Marx liked to debate the merits of collective ownership of the means of production, but what really interested him now was the achievement of this goal through revolution. Some people think that philosophers, including political thinkers, merely engage in idle chatter or full of hot air. They believe that only concrete material forces have an impact on the world around us, such as technology and maybe our genes. Even Marx was thought to have held this view at one point. Yet Marx, and many like him, put the lie to this point. They have certainly had an enormous impact on the world around us, especially on our legal institutions.
Marx's radicalism also offended the institutions of France. The authorities became suspicious of his activities and threw him out of Paris. He went to Belgium, to Brussels, where he and Jenny found lodgings in a scruffy tenement building. Their money was already running out. The secret police in Brussels watched them constantly. For Jenny, the following months were to be a nightmare. Marx would go carousing with friends late into the night, leaving her alone and pregnant in their damp rooms. Once, she was thrown in prison for a night amongst prostitutes. They were kept afloat financially by Engels, an irony since his money came from his capitalist connections. It was at this time that Engels also involved Marx in writing a tract, which was to become one of the best-known documents of history, the Communist Manifesto.
It's a heady propaganda piece, but it lays out the quintessential assault of Marx, the revolutionary. The aims today actually look rather tame, but for their time they were explosive. To have them circulated in print amongst worker groups was outrageous. The intensity of the radical Marx, fomenting revolt, is still the fuel of the revolutionary wing of contemporary Marxism. If you think of them as tabloid headlines, these communist slogans are superb incitements to action, especially to the hot-headed and the desperate.
Marx now traveled widely, talking to worker groups and organizing revolutionary activity. Soon he was to witness the events of 1848, known as the Year of Revolutions. The beautiful revolution in Paris, in which a class struggle between workers, bourgeoisie, and new capitalists led to a provisional government and the declaration of a new republic. That lasted only a few months. He attempted to start a revolution also in Cologne, publishing the new Rheinische Zeitung, a vituperative attack on class interests, printed in red ink. That got him thrown out of Germany. Exiled to London, he involved himself in the International Workers' Association. Here, not for the last time, different strands of socialism were to clash.
Marx attacked what he called the bourgeois utopian socialism of the French led by Proudhon. He attacked anarchic socialism, whose main proponent was the Russian Bakunin. Marx always believed that initially the state had a role to play in socialism. He set himself up as the theorist of revolutionary socialism, which gradually came to call communism.
In fact, internal contradictions in the pan-European socialist movement exploited by Marx himself were to prove the downfall of the International Workers' Association. To prevent others taking power, Marx and Engels manipulated the IWA into moving its offices to, of all places, Philadelphia. There, it simply withered away. 30 years after Marx's death, the IWA was in fact reborn, holding meetings in Basel and Geneva. The Geneva meeting was significant in several ways, not least for the presence of one man whose interpretation of revolutionary Marxism, as we'll see in another program, was to have enormous importance. Lenin. As an exile in London, not only had Marx run out of countries, he'd run out of money. He and Jenny lived in rooms above a laundry in Soho. Once again, he relied on Engels for a living, never giving him any thanks, behavior consistent with his communist views. But now he also wasn't averse to simply scrounging for funds from others. Ironically, Marx's slum dwelling is now on the fourth floor above one of the better restaurants in Soho. Here, Marx was to live, working late into the night, smoking his foul cigars, mulling over the failure of the revolutionary process to immediately bring about the socialist phase of history. In these two rooms, he and Jenny lived with his four children, two of whom were to die here.
Marx had a revolutionary approach. He believed that capitalism needs to be overturned, changed into socialism. How did this idea evolve in his own theoretical view?
It is interesting to observe that Marx did not assume that there would be a political party to lead the workers, but they would learn in terms of the discipline and consequences of their own opposition to capitalism. And as their need intensified, it would culminate in taking power.
What is the major difference between scientific and utopian socialism?
The great difference is that Marx did not believe that you could introduce socialism anytime and anywhere. He assumed that there had to be certain objective conditions to be fulfilled. Now, if you look more closely at that view, I don't think it could stand up to analysis, because we'd have to abandon the whole notion of inevitability or even overwhelming probability. But I think Marx would say, well, the inevitable comes about through the activity of the working class, which itself is inevitable under the circumstances, so that he would not regard this as a contradiction.
Now, this was a time of political upheaval. Was Marx changing his own behavior as a result of these political changes?
At this period, he often denounced those who were always invoking the necessity of using force at any time. And he also criticized those who were interested only in tepid reforms rather and did not aim at the transformation of the entire system. So that there is a pragmatic element in the political aspect of his activity.
Exiled from Europe, Marx was now to research the material basis of scientific socialism. He wanted to find the elements within the forces of history which could transform capitalism through socialism into communism. Engels' hometown, Manchester, England, was the world's first industrial city, its massive growth produced by the newly mechanized textile industry. These are the canals where the cotton was rushed in from America to feed the looms of the Industrial Revolution. Today, the looms are gone, but many mills still stand. You can almost imagine them throbbing with the vibration of steam-powered belts and pulleys, while the looms created the superabundance of capitalism. And along with capital came labor in droves. From all over the country, men, women, and children came to service the capitalist's machinery. Their back-to-back houses clustered around the mills, creating Northern England's unique urban landscape. Overcrowding, compounded by a rapid birth rate, soon produced fetid slums. Marx never visited factories or slums. He collected data from evidence and correspondence and through an obsessive fascination in arcane statistics. He studied at the British Museum and here at Cheetham's Library in Manchester. You can see the books he used here where he and Engels did their research.
Let's look at these statistics. How much land is to be given to the poor for relief? Death rates, land taxes. Political thinkers, they hope to have an influence on the way the world works. Marx, for example, complained that philosophers have thus far only interpreted the world. The point is to change it.
For Marx, the contrast between the good fortune of the capitalist and the misery of the workers was the key to how his communist vision would come about. Quite simply, the workers would revolt. Their lives, delineated by what Engels called the rhythm of the machine, would inevitably be subjected to mere subsistence as any extra wages were dissipated in more children. They would become increasingly alienated from the very system which spawned them, and increasingly unemployed as machinery took their work from them. The capitalist would decrease in numbers. Penny pinching with ever increasing competition, they would experience falling rates of profit. The capitalists would then lower wages even further. The working class would become even more immiserated until eventually the whole capitalist system would destroy itself in an inevitable communist revolution. In his efforts to convert people to his ideas, Marx wrote a book. It was to be his great work, explaining in detail how capitalism would inevitably fail and socialism emerge triumphant. He called it Das Kapital, capital.
This is Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Marx studied this book, just as he did David Ricardo's and Thomas Malthus's works. It was at the time when he was writing Das Kapital, his major work, which was addressed to these economists, which was meant to convince those who were impressed with this economic analysis of society. But of course, it contained Marx's own extremely revised views of these ideas. But its tone, its style, was that of the classical economists. The language of Das Kapital is to us today obscure in the extreme. But you can still see traces of what Karl Marx meant in our contemporary industrial culture. He claimed that the value of what we make is created by the labor which goes into its making. It's an idea borrowed from the economist David Ricardo, except Marx altered it, declaring it true whatever and however much capital is employed. Once created, the product, of course, is owned by the capitalist. Once costs and wages are subtracted, the remaining surplus value is appropriated by the capitalist. The worker, in Marx's phrase, is exploited. This life of wage labor, where one is exploited because the private property owned by the capitalist gives him power over your social being, leads to alienation. You are alienated from yourself. Your labor is sold and isn't an expression of your own creativity. You are alienated from the production process. Division of labor taps only a fraction of your creativity. You're alienated from others. You see them as antagonists in the marketplace when you go to buy something. And you are alienated from the product. It isn't yours, and you will have to pay the capitalist to obtain its benefits, although you created it by your own efforts. Das Kapital is a sustained critique of the industrial capitalist system. But what is offered instead? What is the vision of social order to take capitalism's place? Marx never fully explained. He envisioned mankind free to enjoy creative social labor, including a little philosophizing. In their later years, Marx and Jenny moved to middle-class Hempstead, a legacy helping many of their financial problems. Here on Hempstead Heath, Marx and his family and friends could grasp a bit of the vision. Marx proposes that practical work be serious but joyful, activity for the love of it. He denied that there should be anything but collective property in the means of production. Alienation would be impossible with a classless society living in communist freedom and harmony. Human beings would have developed to their full maturity in perfect union with the material world around them.
And what I find very dangerous about this is the vision of a society in which everyone will automatically love everyone else, in which the individual strangeness of people, their peculiarities, will be abolished.
But couldn't you say that here is a community where we can tolerate individuals and differences? Marx himself believed that individuals always will be found indistinguishable from one another. He was not an egalitarian in the sense that he believed that all human beings acted alike.
So what then is the Marxist vision? What is the
Marxist
vision?
Is an ideal. That's to say, it's not the essence. He's projecting the ideal of a world in which the norm of human activity is creation. Creation in all fields. He says in his future society, there will be no painters. There will be men who paint. There will be no musicians. There will be men who write music.
Well, that's a very specific conception of human nature, don't you think so?
I think it's a very optimistic conception of human nature.
Marx spent his last years writing the final volumes of Das Kapital. He was never to finish them. His undisciplined ways were to leave to Engels the task of collating and publishing his final writings. His beloved Jenny died in 1881, and Marx, desolated and almost friendless, died 15 months later. Today his memorial is a granite plinth from which his bust stares at his many visitors. Here, too, lies a tale, because the monument dates only from 1956. Marx died in obscurity, a little-known philosopher. You can find his first grave deep amongst the trees, a strange anonymity considering the infamy of the name Karl Marx today.
Marx enjoyed his greatest triumphs after his death rather than during his life. Today, the question is, how should we interpret his ambiguous legacy? There are some who seized upon some aspects of his doctrines, have tried to transform it into a form of totalitarianism. There are others who have remained faithful to the democratic tradition, which was central to his teaching.
Today, we've had time to reflect on Marx's ideas. What's left when we analyze the evidence of history in the spirit of his own scientific method? One place to begin is with what many contemporary admirers regard as his democratic ideals, his criticism of the power and privilege of the capital-owning class.
For centuries, this house was occupied by landowners, and for centuries, it was only landowners who were permitted to vote in the parliamentary system of Great Britain. Now, in Marx's time, great changes were taking place. This is the Reform Act of 1832. It extended the franchise, that is the vote, to a great many more people and would eventually bring democracy through a series of other reforms to Great Britain.
Through pressure from many who called themselves socialists, the vote was eventually given to the proletariat. So here in Bacup, the hometown of the clog dancers, it wasn't economic forces alone bringing change. In Victoria Street, the houses back onto a mill and stream, a stream which marks the first boundary dividing Lancashire into what were to be successively smaller constituencies, a reform instigated by the middle classes in Parliament for the workers.
Scholars still debate whether political democracy contradicts Marxism. At least we must grant that a socialist state could begin democratically.
But would such a radical change ever occur? Thousands of working-class men marched out of their mills and off to the trenches in the First World War. For communists, it was a terrible disappointment. This was patriotic nationalism, a cultural loyalty seemingly deeper than the economic bonds of working-class life.
Marxists declared that the working class were duped into fighting a war between capitalists that was none of their business. But can we really explain the courage of these individuals and the grief of their families by uniform confusion as to what was good for them?
Revolutionary Marxists have since Marx's death been waiting for the revolution, but it didn't come in the depressions of the 1870s or the 1930s. It didn't come in 1914, nor against Hitler. Each time, some other social or cultural factor has prevented the economic clash from toppling capitalist progress.
There is another thing about this house that is of significance. This is where Winston Churchill lived. This was his study. Now, Churchill was one of these people who was of great significance in human history. Is there any room for such people in Marxist theory? Dr. Hook, how does the idea of a hero in history, a significant figure, square with Marxist theory that there is an inevitable development in human history?
Only in a very limited sense. In a sense, we always need a great man, but whether or not he appears cannot be determined by the economic factors that Marx was concerned with. There are certain crucial periods at which the action of a great man may be decisive. It's questionable whether Marx's own life and influence could be explained in terms of his own theory. And perhaps the most decisive illustration is provided by the activity of Nikolai Lenin.
There is one other overriding development which is difficult for Marxists to explain. Where in capitalist countries are the immiserated masses which were predicted in Marx's writings?
In 1849, the year Marx went to London, thousands of immigrants came to San Francisco in search of gold. Most of them were almost penniless. Not many found gold, but an enormous number of them got wealthy. Today, downtown San Francisco is full of the mutual funds and other institutions holding the savings of the American working people. Anyone who's commuted daily onto the San Francisco Peninsula across the famous bridges will be aware that the superabundance of a substantially capitalist economy has produced something unexpected. The primary product industries traditional to California are being superseded here in a latter-day industrial revolution. New capitalist bosses and new workers in new factories. What about Marx's economic theories here?
Can the skills in this plant sensibly be explained as those of the working class? The jobs here are varied and different. Any division into warring classes of participants in this economic system does not seem sensible. And does what Marx called socially necessary or skilled labor fully explain the value of the products people produce? The work of these people alone does not explain the value of what they make. That's determined by how well they serve the legitimate wants of consumers.
Let me see.
Marx also largely missed the entrepreneurial element required in production. One of its results can be a whole team of research engineers. Their work is paid for as an economic adventure by the capitalist owner.
It's bought out now.
Okay. What of alienation? Marx's view is hard to divorce from his many problematic assumptions, but if we ask people, and it has been done, we find that most are fulfilled by their work.
But what about unskilled workers? Mr. Quang Dang is one of the Vietnamese boat people. He lives with other immigrants in Santa Clara County. He's got two major interests in his life. One is his music. He's played for the San Jose Orchestra and is continuing to improve his skills with lessons. The other is electronic engineering. Mr. Quang Dang doesn't see the shop floor as the end of the line for him.
He isn't alienated by any reasonable standard, a locked-in member of the working class. He's going to college to improve himself and continues to exploit the opportunities in his work. What we must accept is that there are those who see Marx less democratically. By their interpretation, Marxism requires force.
Given the claims of the East German and other Eastern European states about their relationship to Marxism, what are we to make of this wall here?
I think it's demonstrable that this wall symbolizes the extent to which these societies represent the betrayal of the fundamental principles of Marxism.
Isn't it still arguable that these are the consequences of his ideas?
Would one argue that the medieval Inquisition is a consequence of what Christ taught on the Sermon on the Mount? After all, in history, we have many illustrations where there are illegitimate applications of common doctrines. As I interpret Marx, he was a champion for human freedom, mistaken as he might have been in many of his historical predictions.
One need not blame Marx for everything that is happening here, but one can still say that his ideas were the closest to being supportive to this sort of thing. When he talks, for example, of the abolition of private property and the socialization of the means of production, well, labor is the means of production, and the socialist societies here have taken labor and claimed it their collective property, and therefore they don't allow people to escape out. Because that labor is theirs. It's not the private individual's labor.
That interpretation of Marxism runs counter to Marx's view that the working class would determine its own future. There's not a line in this doctrine where he identifies the rule of the working class with the rule of a minority over the entire society.
Interpretations of Marxism are frustrating. Could one be sure of Sidney's Marxism? Would other Western Marxists agree? Whatever the answer, the wall was getting to me.
This is the vital point of our discussion. On which side of the wall would Karl Marx stand if he were alive today? He is the man who concluded his introduction to Capital by quoting from Dante, "Follow your own course and let people talk." He represented the spirit of freedom and independence, and whether one agrees with his doctrines or not, it seems to me he belongs to this side of the wall in the hope that someday this wall will be raised and all human beings enjoy freedom.
Professor Altvater of Berlin's Free University teaches Marx as part of his university courses. There are more than 300 similar courses taught in the United States. Altvater himself was a 60s radical, a revolutionary Marxist. Revolutionary Marxists are more interested in direct action than in theory. Today, he is very critical of Soviet Marxism, but still believes that Marxism has clear practical significance. What is the major criticism of Western-type Marxists of the Soviet-type Marxists?
Yes, the Soviet-type Marxism is, in the first instance, let us say, very orthodox. Marxism is not a state ideology, and you can't transform a critique in a positivist, let us say, positivist science to base planning systems and so on it. This has nothing to do with Marxism.
What would be a healthiest version of applying Marxism, in your view?
In my view, Marxian theory should best be applied in analyzing your situation, your social situation, your society in which you are living, in which you are fighting sometimes. We are living in so-called democracies. And in such a democracy, it should be possible to analyze this society and to change this society, conforming, of course, with some constitutional boundaries.
Is it possible to still think in terms of the coming socialist or the coming communist societies, or is that all out now? Is that all obsolete?
It's not obsolete. Everybody needs his own or his social utopias. Without utopias, there will be no change, no reform, structural reform of the contemporary societies. But on the other hand, I think that the question of revolution today is much more complicated than 100 years ago.
So it's no longer a matter of capitalists and workers or anything like that?
Not at all. We have always to ask ourselves, what's the proletariat today? What's the working class today? What's work? Work today is another thing than 100 years ago. Class is another thing than 100 years ago. Changing society by reform or revolution is another thing today than 100 years ago.
In the end, is there really any authentic and fruitful Marxism left?
I do not believe there is any authentic Marxist movement. Marx would have said, "I am not a Marxist," with reference to all of those tendencies that claim to be Marxist today. But what is left is a series of insights that can be used by scholars who, whether they call themselves Marxists or not, who are trying to understand the world. In that sense, Marx belongs to the ages.
This does not deny that there are phenomena in our modern democratic world which Marx would have seen as unjust. Socialists today say that our Western liberties are meaningless for those who lack the wealth required to take advantage of them. In San Francisco, the less successful under capitalism huddle south of Market Street, looking up towards the wealth on Nob Hill. The moral indignation or guilt some of us feel about this is endemic in Western culture. What part has Marx's vision to play in this? Sidney Hook was a convinced Marxist and activist in the 1930s. He was involved in public protest and was known as a radical leftist. Since then, in a distinguished academic career, he's reassessed Marx's science of society and stripped away its outdated elements. He has firm views on the remaining value of Marx's vision.
Scientific socialism seems really to be dead. Does that mean that Marx goes back to utopian, moralistic socialism?
Well, no. Myself, we characterize a socialism today, in quotation marks, as a belief in democracy as a way of life and a dedication to the principles of democracy, extending them in other areas in which human beings command too much power in respect to other human beings.
Is this sort of a reintroduction of the Christian ideal of the brotherhood of man, but brought back down to earth from the other world?
What I do recognize that in the history of thought, what religion generally has meant is an awareness of the sense of community. It seems to me that the animating drive behind people who call themselves Marxists of any variety is moral.
American individualism stresses an alternative vision to socialism, that of free, self-starting individuals protected in their person, their belongings, and what they believe by a constitutionally limited and democratically administered government. If Marxism is mere economic democracy, does it clash with the American tradition? Capitalism is based on private property and freedom of the individual.
Agreement with using the high teller stations again.
This meeting at Gensler Associates, a famous San Francisco architect, is discussing a project that none of these individuals can complete on their own.
Wells Fargo is really in need.
Ask any architect what skills are needed to carry out a building project, the list will be almost endless, from steelworkers through electricians to carpet makers, all with their own knowledge of what they do. Genslers have thousands of samples from hundreds of suppliers to choose from for their interior designs.
Closer to that. Okay. What do you think of these? I wasn't very satisfied with these here.
Voluntary exchange of property among thousands of individuals and firms creates our prosperity. Furthermore, instituting collective, albeit democratic, decisions as a substitute for this is very hazardous to our political liberties. Socialists would say that competition here in San Francisco is destructive of human cooperation. But in fact, isn't it the case that commercial relationships sometimes give rise to many other relationships, friendship, respect, camaraderie, and that commerce really isn't as insidious as imagined? If a collective were to decide that selling teddy bears, skimmed milk, or calculators was unacceptable, then it's not only that the property rights of the trader would be infringed, many of our other vital values would go as well. It is no coincidence that many who live behind the Iron Curtain find life dull, as well as short on prosperity. I believe the moment one acts in the spirit of the Marxist vision, either through abridging private property or even economic regulation, one infringes fundamental liberties which America has cherished from its foundation. Sidney Hook disagrees.
The basic issue today, especially, is the preservation of the right of the community to determine for itself the economic system under which it wants to live and all other institutions.
Well, you see, here is where I have a problem with this, because I don't see communities as having rights. Individuals have rights. Communities are not beings with the capacity to have rights. Let me make the point further.
And I agree with you. All rights are centered in individuals. And when I speak of community rights, I'm speaking of the rights of individuals. And therefore, I recognize that property is a human right, but it's not the only human right. We have a cluster of rights. It's a matter of using your intelligence from case to case, how far you would go with extending human freedom and restricting it. And we do that all the time.
But sometimes you need a certain amount of
security, predictability in a society, so that, for example, the right to private property over a few years, you need to know whether you can invest or whether you can sell or whether you are in control of your own destiny in as much as it's tied in with property.
We would say, yes, you can own as much property as you want to until a point is reached where your control of property affects the public welfare, the public good.
This almost introduces a dictatorship.
No, on the contrary, so long as you've kept the processes of freely given consent open, then there is no dictatorship involved.
But you seem to think that somehow the people will rise with wisdom to the occasion to do this, you know.
Well, one has to have a certain faith in democracy. Sometimes I cling to it by the skin of my teeth. But what are the alternatives?
There's the alternative of a limited democracy like the American Constitution has amongst us.
Well, I'm
democracy
prepared to accept
limited
it.
To the selection of our representatives, not to everything, not to science, education, economics.
That's true. It's limited to government. But in the American system, we certainly have a right to introduce legislation that affects the welfare of the community.
I consider it the erosion of the American system, unfortunately.
Well, I'm prepared to accept the American Constitution and its aims to provide for common defense, to provide the public welfare. And very often, if you want to provide for the public welfare, you may have to modify the absolute right of individuals to exclude others from the use of what they own.
I, on the other hand, would recommend that we really keep the government out of it as much as possible. I think that's the difference.
This has between us a difference, and that's a difference.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.